Contact's WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. And with me are my fellow host, Gus Canavero.
Hey, everybody.
And behind the board doing double duty, our military affairs commentator, Marshawn.
Good afternoon, everyone.
You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. At our website, incontextreport.com, you can check out our archive, our blog, and sign up for podcasts of In Context. And you can also watch In Context videos on YouTube. In today's program, which is the eve of the anniversary of 9/11, we're going to examine in detail the Oklahoma City terrorist bombing of the Muro Federal Building on April 19, 1995. This attack, terrorist attack, killed 168 people and injured more than 680. Among the dead were 19 children under the age of 6. Has the government told the truth about the Oklahoma City bombing?
Unlikely.
And are there parallels to 9/11? To answer these questions, we're very pleased to have with us James Lane, director of A Noble Lie, a documentary film on the Oklahoma City bombing. Mr. Lane, thanks very much for joining us on In Context.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Could you please start by giving us the government's account of what happened in the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, honestly, that's very difficult to do because there's so many different stories. It depends on where you go. Mm. It seems like each agency had their own version. The memorial has its version.
Well, let's start with Tim McVeigh. What is he supposed to have done?
So the general official story is that, yes, Timothy McVeigh acted in conjunction with Terry Nichols and built an ammonium nitrate and fuel oil bomb, referred to as ANFO, and then drove it to the Muro Building, AP Muro Building in Oklahoma City, and set it off at 9:02 a.m. on April 19, 1995. Now, they say that McVeigh was in the truck by himself at that time, and that that was that explosion is what caused the damage to the AP Muro Building.
And now you say the stories, though, the accounts are not consistent from the government.
Right. Like I say, if you go to the Oklahoma Bombing Memorial, they have their version. FEMA has theirs. ATF has theirs. But that is the general, I guess, consensus between all the stories. When we were putting together the outline for A Noble Lie, it was difficult to really, because we said we were going to, deconstruct the official story, and we found it was difficult to put it into one, just find one official story.
And, of course, Tim McVeigh was executed for his role in the bombing, and Terry Nichols, I understand, got a life sentence for
yes,
assisting the bomb making. Now, what does this all have to do? The attack had something to do with the April 19th, 1993 massacre of the Branch Davidians. Can you talk about that connection with the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, and that's what they say was McVeigh's primary motive behind the attack. And it was that, the people in Waco that had died, and this was retaliation towards that. But I think really we have to look at all of the other things that were surrounding, that day. Everybody that saw McVeigh, including the prosecution's own witnesses, saw McVeigh with John Doe number 2.
Mm-hmm.
And we're supposed to just forget that this guy existed, And as a, Oklahoma native, I want to see everybody that was involved brought to justice.
In fact, there were APBs, all points bulletins, mm-hmm, out mm-hmm. for this John Doe number
right.
2, right? Right after the explosion?
Yes. And, we just want to see everybody, that was involved brought to justice. Nobody is saying that McVeigh didn't do what he did. But we said there were additional perpetrators that were involved that the American people are supposed to just forget about. And, the media still loves to refer to anybody that, tries to resist our loss of freedom as a McVeigh. You're one of those anti-government haters
mm-hmm. Right.
or killing children. It's just ridiculous. Whenever you go to anoblelie.com and get the movie, you'll see the full story behind what happened. We really wanted to encapsulate the survivors and victims' family members' stories into one package. Because, a lot of these folks were getting up in age. Actually, two people that we interviewed for the documentary have already passed away. and others said that this is the last interview that they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Gus, you have a question?
Yeah, James. I want to talk about who McVeigh was, some of the backstory of him, so that we can kind of shed some light on either the motivations or the potential misdirection in the characterization of McVeigh. We know that he requested his execution to be moved up, and that was granted, and he died in 2000, right? He was executed in 2000? You know, he was involved in this place, Elohim City, which was potentially run by or at least extremely infiltrated by the FBI or the Southern Poverty Law Center. You mentioned in the film that there was a satellite that was pointed directly at Elohim City, that there was a German intelligence agency there, or agent by the name of Andy Strassmeyer, and Carol Howe, who's an ATF informant in Elohim City. So they at least got to know McVeigh, and he was part of the military. And why don't you just talk a little bit about who he was and what led him up to the bombing of the Oklahoma City bombing building? Or the,
You know, whenever you look at you know, McVeigh's you know, early history, he was the good soldier. They said, you know, people that that knew him at the time said that, you know, he could be given an order to sit there and polish a rock, and he'd sit there for days polishing it until, you know, he told him to stop. he was the good soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you know, as he closer to the timing of the bombing, he started you know, making a lot of vocal statements about, you know, anti-government type of statements. Mm-hmm. And you know, we see this in a lot of other, you know, Patsy type situations where they start to create this legend.
Well, that's kind of like the parallel to Lee Harvey Oswald. Here you have a guy who was, I think, recruited for the Special Forces. Then, as I understand it from your film, he left the training program, but he said in letters to his family that he was being, he'd actually been switched to some kind of covert operation where he might be involved in illegal drug trafficking or maybe even assassinations,
mm-hmm.
right? So
yeah,
so he has that that smell of Oswald, of a, perhaps a low-level covert operative guy who maybe was sheep-dipped.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And the letter from the family, they found it very confusing. They're saying, why are they, is the media and the government saying that he's not involved with the military anymore? It was their idea that he was actually, you know, still working in covert operations.
Mm-hmm.
They found it very confusing. This is in the transcripts of the telephone conversations. And then, you know, you also mentioned the letter that he wrote to the family, saying that he would be involved even as far as assassinating security risks.
And then he goes up to Buffalo right after he leaves the service, and he's involved with radical groups. And it kind of brought to my mind Lee Harvey Oswald with
the Fair
Play for Cuba, which we now know was set up by U.S. intelligence to create a new image for Oswald as kind of leftist nut.
Right. Now, he gets into involved with the folks at Elohim City.
Yes.
Now, they deny it, you know, but we actually went out there and talked with someone that lived there, but was there at the time, and he saw McVeigh and Strassmeyer there in Elohim City at the same time. Also, McVeigh got a traffic ticket near Elohim City, the White Separatist compound. Telephone records show that, you know, he was calling the surrounding areas, And so, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of evidence and eyewitness testimony to show that he was there. And as you mentioned, this is at the same time that ATF informant Carol Howe was telling her handlers that, you know, they are talking about blowing up a federal building.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, way before the attack, to the point where she was even, you know, telling people that she knew to stay away from, you know, the federal building.
Mm-hmm. This lady's an ATF informant operating in this really crazy Elohim City, what are they, white supremacist group. She's infiltrated, and she's witnessing conversations where people are talking about blowing up buildings. In fact, didn't she take a drive to Oklahoma City with some of the other members where they were scouting targets?
Yeah, they were actually scouting locations, and then, you know, after the attack, the ATF says, oh, well, she was incredible. Well, she was credible all up until that point, and, you know, and she is on record, you know, before the attack saying that, you know, this was going to happen. This thing bring up Andrea Strassmeyer, he's really one of the threads that tie this whole story together.
Mm-hmm. Where does he come from, Strassmeyer?
From Germany, and he does have ties to German intelligence. And, you know, it seems like every step along the way, you know, here is this Andre Strassmayer character. He was infiltrating, I'll have to get into that in a larger context, but he was actually at a militia in Texas, and they saw him entering a federal building using a key code, and at that point he had to leave, and that's where he went up to Elohim City and became head of security there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was going on at the time, we'll get into Jesse Trinidou, I'm sure, a little bit later, but
yeah.
Part of Jesse's he's an attorney trying to get justice for his brother, but part of his FOIA request and the information that he's uncovered, it really has been focused now on an operation called PATCON. PATCON was short for Patriot Conspiracy. This is where they were sending agents in to the various Patriot groups around the country and trying to instigate violence. These were federal agents trying to instigate violence. And the operation out of Elohim City, it looks like it was a PATCON operation with Andre Strassmayer participating.
Does it look like the actual suggestion to blow up the building came from Strassmayer or Carol Howe?
That would be speculation.
Yes.
I don't know. But we do know that PATCON was in full force at the time, and Jesse's continuing to pursue that avenue of investigation. But it seemed like every time, you know, to quote Jesse, it seemed like every time you had five guys sitting around talking about overthrowing the government, four of them worked for the government.
Mm-hmm. So it would be realistic to say that the ATF had prior knowledge of the threat against the Murrah building.
Well, absolutely. And you mentioned the one of the other documents that Jesse uncovered through his FOIA request. It says that there was a CIA spy satellite pointed at Elohim City the morning of the bombing.
Right.
Now, back in 1995, it took a lot of coordination to move a satellite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like, oh, well, there was a bombing, and now let's move the satellite over there. No, they were watching that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so the parallels here, tomorrow is the anniversary of 9/11, and one of the things that we've covered ad nauseum, and so have many other activists out there, is the government's prior knowledge to the threats against the World Trade Center buildings, both back in 1993 and in 2001. And they at least failed to act. So, I mean, there is criminal charges that need to be filed seriously against members of the government on both of those accounts. And again, the common thread is prior knowledge. The government always seems to know that these threats exist and fails to act on them to protect the American citizens accordingly.
Well, in the 93 bombing, I mean, it gets even worse. You've got Ahmad Salam on record
tapes.
With a recording with his FBI handler saying that, you know, the FBI gave them the live explosive.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so if you just say that over again, people are probably not aware. That's just a 1993 attempted destruction of the World Trade Center, that the fellow who provided the bomb was
Ahmad Salam.
Okay, he was
informant.
What? He was
the informant who was actually providing the live explosives to the fellows who carried it out. At first, he was supposed to rig it with a dummy charge, and then the FBI told him to give him a real charge so that they could make the charges or the criminal case stick more severely.
He was an agent provocateur. Then were there other people involved then who didn't know what was going on? Didn't know that he was an agent provocateur?
Yeah. And you know, he goes into the witness relocation program, and so, you know, no one's ever been able to talk to him since. But recording that he did, because he was getting nervous about them giving him live explosives, he was recording the conversations with his FBI handler, and that's been out. And, I mean, I think CBS even did a story on
that's
it.
That's right.
And what happened to Andy Strassmayer?
Andre Strassmayer was actually whisked out of the country through Mexico after the Oklahoma City bombing. The extent of the FBI investigation into Strassmayer was a phone call. Were you involved? No. Okay.
That's kind of reminiscent of Rowan Atkinson's shtick, where he asks, you know, how would you go about finding a German spy? And this one character, Boldrick, turns to him and says, well, you know, I think we should just go to everybody in the hospital and ask them, are you a German spy? It was me, I'd own up. And Rowan Atkinson says, of course you would, but the Germans haven't added to the entry requirement, must have intellectual capacity of a boiled potato.
Right. Well, now, whenever you look at that, if you want to call that an investigation, in comparison to the FBI harassment that federal grand jury member Hoppy Heidelberg experienced just for having the audacity to follow the rule book that he got about grand juries and asking to you know, be able to call witnesses and look at documents.
Yeah, could you talk about how that grand jury came about? Because it really shows it's a widespread suspicion in Oklahoma of the government's account.
Yeah, well, now that was the federal grand jury. And Hoppe actually, like I said, he read the manual that, that all federal grand jury members get, and he was asking to see witnesses. He was like, you know, why would you show me, you know, all this stuff? He was like, McVeigh went to a gun show. He goes, well, who cares? You know, let me call witnesses. Let's look at the architectural drawings. Let's do this. And they said that that he was no longer needed on the grand jury, and he experienced a lot of FBI intimidation. I mean, when they were at his house, you know, they'd pull their jacket back and show their weapon.
So he was attempting to conduct a real investigation, and they were stymieing him.
Right, which was within his rights as a federal grand jury member.
Mm-hmm.
But he said basically when that decision came down, it had everything that the FBI stamp of approval on it. And, you know, they was obviously pushing an agenda. Now, there was a multi-county grand jury that State Representative Charles Key put together, and this was to investigate the Oklahoma City bombing. And what they did is they turned over the grand jury to Bob Macy, the district attorney, and he used the grand jury to actually investigate the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee.
So they didn't really want the investigation in the DA's office, and it was really forced on them by this civic movement. They just basically misdirected it?
Yes, and took the money and investigated the people that were actually trying to, you know, they didn't panel the grand jury. And Oklahoma is one of the few states where you can, the citizens can call for a multi-county grand jury.
Mm. Now, James, we're going to open the phones in a few minutes, but we really need to touch on
if the phone's working.
we need to touch on first the important information you have about from armaments experts about the capability of an ANFO bomb to do the kind of destruction that occurred at the Murrow Building. Could you talk about, for example, General Ben Parton's research?
Sure. Yeah, and there's a couple of aspects of this that we really need to get into to understand it. You know, overall. One of the hallmarks of an ANFO bomb, be it 41 years ago at Sterling Hall up in Wisconsin, or, you know, any time that the IRA would do that, or, you know, in Ireland, the hallmark of an ANFO bomb is a nitric gas cloud. First responders to the scene of one of these bombings, the inhalation of the nitric gas sears their lungs and they wind up being hospitalized. This is consistent with every ANFO bomb, except for the one in Oklahoma City. We have Officer Terrence Shakey, who was on the scene within minutes, saved 8 people's lives that day, and he had no problem with respiration. The survivors that we interview in the movie say, yes, there was no problem with respiration other than a little bit of a sulfur smell from some of the cars that were on fire and the gasoline that was in the cars and the tires. There was a truck bomb, of course, but whether or not it was ammonium nitrate and fuel, I think is questionable. There were additional ordnance inside the building, I can say with all confidence, this because whenever you've got people that were in the building, I'm going to believe them over anybody else.
And there were news reports right at the minutes later, right?
Of undetonated ordnance, right?
Right, from the local news media, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, the local media was obviously, I mean, the early stages were, you know, telling the truth. They were actually, you know, having witnesses and, you know, that were there to tell their story. But these guys were all saying that they thought it was an earthquake. V.Z. Lawton was actually hit in the head with debris and knocked under his desk before the glass blows in. Jane Graham, she worked for HUD. She said that she was at a Windows 95 training course, and the instructor said, it's an earthquake, get under your desk. She said, it doesn't feel like an earthquake, and then the glass blows in. Other people, you know, were under the desk. Now, according to the FEMA report, the blast wave from the truck bomb was traveling at 1,700 feet per second. Now, you explain to me how these people have time to realize something's going on, identify it as an earthquake, and then react and get another desk. That's about an 8 to 10 second time frame, which corresponds to the seismograph readings that we have at various locations in Oklahoma for multiple blasts.
Which corresponds more with a controlled demolition style takedown of a building, right, where you have a sequential demolition of different columns in an order?
Yes, and whenever you couple that with Brigadier General Parton's analysis of the bombing, he shows where the explosives would have been placed to do the damage. We also have a quote from Dr. Samuel Cohen, the inventor of the neutron bomb, that says it would be against the laws of nature for ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, no matter how much was used, to do the damage that was seen at the Murrah building.
What about the column that was closer to the Ryder truck that was shown to be completely untouched, but then column B3, which was further away, had a complete collapse?
Yeah, and the major bite in the building, you know, when you see the iconic image of the Murrah building,
right,
there's a big bite into the building.
Mm-hmm.
That was offset considerably from the crater where the truck bomb had gone off. So, yes, there were columns farther away that were destroyed. Columns in between that destroyed column and the truck bomb were still intact with the sheetrock left on it.
And now General Ben Parton was just not at home.
In the JFK assassination, where you've got the magic blast here at the Oklahoma City bombing that goes forward and takes a right-hand turn into the building.
Mm.
Now, General Parton was actually the former head of Air Force Armaments, so he really was an expert on the subject. So his conclusion was it wasn't an ampho bomb, but rather four bombs placed on columns within the building, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in addition to the truck bomb, there were additional ordnance inside the building. And the ATF denies that they had any weapons or explosives. And one of the sheriffs that were on the scene in the early hours of the bombing, Sheriff Sumter, tape. We actually see them taking, battle rifles and blocks of what looks like C4 out of the rubble.
And what you mentioned in your, or there's a very interesting interview with Jane Graham in your film, as you mentioned, a federal employee who said that shortly before the bombing, she saw people with putty and wires in the basement of the building, in the garage.
Yeah.
And so one of the people looked like Andy Strassmeyer.
Exactly. And so, she thought they were GSA workers working on the telephone. So they had maps and wires and this putty. And whenever she described that, we, talked to other people who have had demolition training. They said that's exactly the way you string C4 with dead cord. Now, she identified him as Andre Strassmeyer later. See, she didn't realize at the time. But once, people started doing their independent investigation, then Strassmeyer's picture started going around. She said, like, that's the guy I saw in the basement. Now, we're still uncovering information about this, 17 years on. We had Jane Graham in studio doing a radio interview, and we got started talking about that, and she described the car that she saw in the basement. Well, that car matches a police report where Andre Strassmeyer had been pulled over, so it matches his car. And she didn't know about that, and we didn't know that she had identified a vehicle in the basement. So it's not just him, it's his car, too.
Yes, sir.
So why don't we go ahead and open the phones, James, and we can get some listeners' calls. And our telephone number here to call in is 203-336-9756. If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport. And we're talking with director James Lane about his documentary film, A Noble Lie, which is about the Oklahoma City bombing, the terrorist attack of 1995, 6 years before 9/11. So if you'd like to speak to Mr. Lane about the bombing, call in to us at 203-336-9756, or you can drop us an email, if you'd rather, at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we will read your question or your comment on the air.
And now I have another question about McVeigh's background. In the film, I think you mentioned that his death certificate mentioned or states his employer as the United States government, indicating that he's in the Army.
U.S. Army.
U.S. Army, okay. And now, are you familiar with David Hammer's book, Deadly Secrets? He was the cellmate of McVeigh during his stay on death row. He did an interview, I think, with Alex Jones, May 14th, 2010. Where he talked about his book and his talks with McVeigh and his time with him. And McVeigh said that he worked with the government till the very end, and that he believed that he was going to be brought back to life after his fake execution. Did you look into this at all?
Yes. And
is there any credibility to it?
I'm sorry?
Is there any credibility to it?
That's what I was going to say. Unfortunately, Mr. Hammer has some credibility issues, and
mm-hmm.
So I really haven't pursued that much farther. I'm not saying that he's wrong, but it just wasn't enough to continue to pursue.
Right.
I will say that Janie Coverdale. She lost her two boys and her two grandkids in the bombing, and she was actually there at the execution. And she says that she saw his chest rise and fall, you know, when he was leaving. What that means, I don't know. But as far as McVeigh stating, you know, that he was, you know, an operative working for the government, I think that you know, all of the information, like we said, with the family's phone records, the letters, things like that, that pretty much establishes his perspective on that.
Okay.
Do you have a gut feeling about whether Timothy McVeigh was thought he was doing a covert op, or whether he was, in fact,
Whether he was really executed or not is kind of pointless. It's whether he believed that he was an operative up to the end.
Yeah, well, I mean, this has all the hallmarks of a sting operation. Now, that's not discounting the government's involvement, or, you know, I don't think that they're mutually exclusive, but I think that most of the bureaucrats and agents that were involved had no idea that this thing was going to come down like it did. I think that they were, the ATF had some really bad publicity with Ruby Ridge and Waco prior to this.
Yeah, could you talk about Ruby Ridge for a second? What was that for the listeners who may not know?
Oh, Ruby Ridge was where there was basically they set up a guy that with the weapons charges, and then, you know, wound up having the ATF all surround him with a big standoff. And
this is the Randy Weaver family.
Yeah, that killed Randy Weaver's wife and his little boy, and so yeah, there was a lot of backlash from that and Waco, bad publicity, and I think that this looks like it was a sting operation that they thought, okay, well, they could get the, you know, good publicity and increase their funding, et cetera. And for whatever reason, you know, however you want to look at it, it got taken live by some element. And I think that, again, the rank-and-file bureaucrat and agent probably didn't know what the final outcome was, but they will act in the axiom of their own self-interest afterwards to be involved in the cover-up, because to preserve the institutions, their pensions, et cetera, and to, you know, eliminate you know, in prosecution against themselves, that they, you know, their fingerprints are all over everything, you know, they're going to be involved in the cover-up, even though they may not have known the bigger picture.
Let's talk about the cover-up. Can you talk about some of the important key characters who were involved with the cover-up then, like Eric Holder? Wasn't he involved, and now he's back in the director's chair again?
Yeah. Well, this is why we say, you know, that it's so important to pursue these cases even, you know, 17 years on. I said, well, you know, let it go. It's, you know, how much time has to pass before you let it go? Well, the people that were involved in the cover-up are still in positions of power.
Right. Yeah. Eric Holder, you're talking about the current Attorney General of the United States. And what was his role back in 1995?
He was associated with Janet Reno.
Mm-hmm. I see.
He was her assistant, right?
Reno. Yeah. But look at Fast and Furious now.
Okay? Exactly, exactly.
We've got him on record on C-SPAN saying that they're going to have to brainwash the American people. He uses the word brainwash.
Yeah.
The American people into thinking differently about gun control. We've got the ATF's own internal memos on Fast and Furious saying that they're going to capitalize on this event to enact further gun control legislation.
And this is another example.
Over 2,000 human beings have died in Fast and Furious. Not just the American deaths, I mean, the Mexican citizens' deaths, too. Mm-hmm. And they're willing to ride those people's ashes to enact gun control legislation. Why would we think anything different about any of these other events?
Sure, and they just didn't hold or just issue a report saying that he was bringing to a close all investigations of alleged torture by the CIA. And
it came out. why would we want to look into that?
And it came out like the same day. A new report came out from some Libyan witnesses about much more extensive torture by the CIA. But he said, there's no case closed.
Nothing to see here. Yeah, move along.
Nothing to see here. Right.
It kind of is that feeling that we're turning into, you know, the Soviet Union, where, people just disappear, you know, or the government does things, they rewrite history, and we have to accept it as fact. I mean, that sounds like the borderline of what they're trying to get to eventually.
Yeah. Speaking about people disappearing, you tell the story of a police officer, Terry.
Yes.
Yakey, was it, who was conducting his own kind of investigation. Can you tell his story?
What a strange story that is.
Yeah, well, and actually I'll let you guys know that we're in the works in a fictional a representation of Terry's story. You can go to unshieldedmovie.com. It's in its early phase of production here, but we're going to continue to pursue that.
Oh, tremendous.
Terry Yakey was a real hero. He saved 8 people's lives that day. He gave up his own personal time to work with kids in schools. He worked for the DARE program. You know, a real pillar of the community. He had gotten the Medal of Valor. He had just reconciled with his wife. He was on his final interview with the FBI to become a FBI agent. So he had everything to live for. I got the key to the city, all this recognition. Well, but he was told to change his report. When he first filled out his report, he was told to take it back and change it. Mm-hmm. He continues to tell his family, on the verge of tears that what they're saying isn't how it really happened, you know. And he tried to keep his family safe. He didn't share the information that he, whatever it was that he knew, with his family. And he was on his way to take some of those records to a storage facility, and he was then going to go have a meal with a friend of his. The last phone conversation he had with this person said that, I'm going to shake these people that are following me, and then I'll meet up with you. Well, he never made it. The official story is that he committed suicide. Well, apparently this is how it happened. He cut several lacerations onto his arms in the car, and part of his neck, and bled out into the car so much that they said you could dip the blood out with a ladle. Then he walks over a mile away, or I'm sorry, drags himself over a mile away because there's grass in all of his wounds, and then leans up against a tree and shoots himself at a downward angle from the top of his head coming out of his jaw with a small caliber weapon at a far enough distance not to leave powder residue. Okay.
Now, why bother with all this stuff? I mean, if you're an assassin going to kill him, why bother dragging him all the way out in the woods and shooting him after he's been cut to death?
Now when I talk with other people about this, folks that have done some investigations and other types of experiences like this, it looks like it was possibly an interrogation prior to his murder,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
where they were trying to get information from him.
I see.
All of the records that he had in the car were gone. By the time the FBI does their inventory, mm-hmm. there's no records, of course. It looks like it was to put fear into Terry. So they were trying to get some sort of information from him. Mm-hmm. But no autopsy was done. They tried to badmouth him and say that, he was high on drugs. Well, they did do an alcohol test on his blood. It did do that much, and it came up negative. He had no alcohol or drugs in his system.
Unbelievable.
Sounds like part of it is there is a psychological fear factor that goes on here because especially other law enforcement officers have to look at this and say, hey, we're not stupid. We know he didn't kill himself.
Yeah.
But then in the same vein, you see somebody who's been so grotesquely murdered. I mean, for most people, that might be an incentive enough to get them to shut up. But it also is reminiscent of Ken, you probably remember this. Who's that fellow who supposedly shot himself, wrapped himself up in a carpet,
Vincent
and dumped himself?
Vince Foster.
Listeners may remember that scandal occurred during the Clinton administration. He was a highly placed advisor to Clinton, and he was killed in a park. His body was found in a park in Washington, D.C., but it was evident from what they could gather is that he had been killed killed elsewhere, that it was not the suicide they said, but he'd been wrapped in a rug
because he had carpet fibers on his clothes. Now, of course, I mean, I know how common it is for people to shoot themselves, wrap themselves up in a carpet, drive themselves to the park, and dump themselves in the woods just to be nice. But
and here again, there was no autopsy, there was no x-ray.
There was also a naval officer, and this goes all the way back to the Kennedy assassination. There was a naval officer involved in the investigation of the Kennedy assassination who supposedly shoots himself in the head in his office with his right hand. He's left-handed. And he supposedly shoots himself in the head with his right hand, and his hand is mangled or appears to have been, manipulated. I mean, there's like a history of this.
It was about intimidation, mm-hmm. Other police officers, I mean, that was basically what was said after that was, don't end up like Barry Yakey. Now, Officer Don Browning was part of the canine search and rescue, and he was friends with Terry. And there were a lot of people, coming to him and other police officers, wanting to know what was going on and wanting to share the information that they had that was contradictory to what the FBI was putting out. And a FBI agent said to Don Browning, Oklahoma City Police Officer Don Browning, people that ask questions like you, them and their wife usually end up dead.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it was stated to him, it was a threat. And then you see what happened with Terry and, overall intimidation. They were going to railroad this official story through no matter what. Anybody that got in their way,
right.
Was going to pay the price.
Well, they had a lot to lose.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show, and we're speaking with James Lane, the director of the movie A Noble Lie, which raises some serious questions about the government's account of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd like to call in and participate.
Folks can get that, go to the website, anoblelie.com, to pick up a copy.
And you can speak directly with Mr. Lane right now by calling us at 203 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or send us an email to ken@mdrtalk.org.
Yeah, even if you'd just like to comment and just say that you are interested in the comment in the topic, just feel free to drop us a line. Sometimes people don't like to call in when we're talking about this stuff because it's fast. Yeah, the information comes so fast and that they don't want to call and interrupt it. But feel free to give us a call. Mr. Lane, can you go, speaking of murder, can you go into Jesse Trenadue and what happened to his brother?
Yeah, Kenneth Trenadue was picked up on a parole violation.
Mm-hmm.
He was on parole. He had robbed some banks and such, and but he had done his time and he was paroled, and he bore a striking resemblance to one of the folks that they was suspected to be John Doe number two. And what it looks like was that they mistook him for them, and the ends justify the means, I guess. And they killed him in the federal transfer facility there in Oklahoma City. Now they said it was a suicide, and by suicide he tried to cut his throat with a open the metal out of the toothpaste container, choked himself, tried to hang himself, and then when he fell, he smashed his head in on the bed, all this ridiculous stuff. When you look at it, he has bruises on the bottom of his feet. He had a caffeine level in his system that was extremely high, and this is consistent with torture.
Mm-hmm.
Caffeine increases the pain, during torture.
Right.
He's got marks all on his arms, finger marks and bruises where he had been held. Other witnesses in the area, that were there in the federal transfer facility, so said that they could hear it going on, and he really did put up the fight of his life.
Yeah.
James, what parallels do you see? Because we only have about 15 minutes left in the show. I do want to get your thoughts on the parallels between Oklahoma City bombing and 9/11.
Well, wait. What Jesse Trenadue uncovered was kind of important. You've got to get to that point. Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, and so Jesse, his brother, is an attorney, and whenever he goes to find out what's going on, they're like, "Well, no, he doesn't have any family." And they're like, "No, he's got a brother, a mother, a wife, children," and that's when they really went into cover-up mode, and that's where Eric Holder put out a memo about Trenadue's and Trenadon's, that they were bringing their full force to bear against him to cover this up. Jesse has been working tirelessly ever since his brother's death to get justice, and through the FOIA request and I have to give credit to the judge there in Salt Lake City, the federal judge that is actually taking the CIA and the FBI to task on presenting finding this information they say that they can't find, like the videotapes. There were videotapes all surrounding the Oklahoma City area. The Murrah Building area, and they say that all of those tapes are being changed at the exact same time, not at 2 a.m.
Well, that sounds very familiar, missing videotapes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon.
They can't find it. Now the FBI, they just can't find it. Jesse continues to this day to pursue this case, and he didn't start out trying to find out about the Oklahoma City bombing. He was just trying to solve his brother's murder.
Mm-hmm.
But all the roads led to the Oklahoma City bombing, and now some of the best information has come out through his efforts, and we really do have to thank him and give him credit, because we wouldn't know we wouldn't know about PatCon if it wasn't for him.
Yeah, right. It's really independent investigators like you, Mr. Lane, and like Jesse's brother, who are really bringing out the truth about this.
And speaking of the tapes, I remember, I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where they released the missing footage of the Oklahoma City bombing security film, and it stops recording right at the point of the bomb blast, and then picks up 5 minutes later after the bomb has exploded. And they say, "Well, the camera stopped working." We want to know what that would have showed.
They were changing the tapes.
Oh, they were changing the tapes.
That was actually Jesse's FOIA request that even got that much out. But now, whenever they ask for the rest of them, the FBI saying they can't.
How coincidental!
Exactly.
What about all the private businesses that had tapes running on that, covering
they
the building.
The FBI confiscated any video that was in this room.
We're not allowed
and
to
again,
see
it. And again, it isn't like the Pentagon where everybody wants to see the impact of the plane and the Pentagon.
But we get those five crappy angles with the single frames.
And yet there are many videotapes. All are state secrets.
My question is always, you know, if because people tend to blindly believe, well, that's the government line, that's the government line. But if the government has nothing to hide, if the government is telling the truth, why can't they show us the videos, whether it's
of
the Pentagon or Oklahoma City?
I think what's really important is to have the scientific evidence. You have General Ben Parton, and you have, who is the Air
Stubblebine.
Force? Stubblebine. Stubblebine.
I can tell you with absolute authority, it was not a plane that hit the Pentagon.
And this general, well, like Ben Parton, was an expert in that field. In his case,
I analyze photos for a living.
And he said it was not a plane that hit the Pentagon. And I think when you look at the science of, say, 9/11, especially World Trade Center number 7, mm-hmm. and you look at the science of Ben Parton or the Wright Armaments Laboratory in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing. They blew up an info bomb, I learned from your film, right? Right, Mr. Lane?
The Wright Armaments Laboratory, they did. They constructed, reconstructed the entire bomb, and they said that the separate barrels, the air gap between the barrels, when the blast occurred, it canceled each other out and pushed most of it upward, upward.
Mm-hmm.
They constructed a single larger bomb and set it off on a weaker test structure than the Murrah Building, and it did less damage. So finally, they put something inside, and so that was their determination. The Air Force's own determination was that there were additional ordnance inside the building.
And this kind of brings to mind the conversation we had with Professor Stephen Jones, who I imagine you know, who talked about how after 9/11 tests were done on the steel, by the Underwriters Lab, and the steel didn't fail, even though it was subjected to heat greater than the fires that existed in the World Trade Center.
Well, you know, the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, headed up by Charles Key, wanted to, do independent testing on some of the materials, and that was all buried in a landfill under armed guard, and no one was ever allowed to.
Yeah, how did the building happen to come down? Why didn't anybody go in and do a forensic
after a month?
Yeah, what was the story about bringing the building down?
Oh, well, they said that it was too painful for people, that they needed to hurry up and to take the building down, even though the engineer said that it could be rebuilt. they put everybody's mind at ease, they had to hurry up. And
again, like 9/11, there was no professional forensic job.
No, it's rapid. It's right away. Get rid of the evidence so that no one has a chance to investigate.
What did they do with the World Trade Center debris? I think it was shipped off
to China,
and they never had fire marshals come in and look at the stuff to see, well, was it a bomb? Was it a fire?
And ironically, the Murrah Building, even though that undoubtedly had extra charges placed on the columns, it still only took down half the building, but Trade Center 7 right to the ground, the whole building symmetrical free fall speed.
Well, I think that it was actually intended to bring the entire building down. There were some additional ordnance that were unexploded that the bomb squad took out that day.
Yeah.
And that's really important, is that
the building completely down.
We talked about that
earlier.
That
shows how difficult it is to take a building down, even when you're trying.
But those additional bombs were reported, what was it, KFOR? Local station.
They were doing great. Just getting out the truth about what was going on. But then they were bought out by the New York Times, and the program director and lead reporter their contracts weren't renewed.
Oh, wait, all
reporting that contradicted the official stories was silenced.
That outlet is the one that went out to the motel where McVeigh was staying with the Ryder truck, right? And that everyone said that he was there with someone else.
Yes, with multiple people.
Right, multiple people.
I mean, everybody saw him. Where he rented the truck, the people at the rental place said they saw him with additional people.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody saw him along the way, saw him with different, additional people. It's just, that's one of the major, consistencies with that whole time, is that everybody saw him with additional perpetrators.
If you'd like to call into the show, we're speaking to Mr. James Lane, director of the film A Noble Lie, about the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995. The first, I think it was the first mass casualty terrorist attack. Give us a ring at 203-336-9756. We just have 10 minutes left, so please give us a ring if you want to speak to Mr. Lane at 203-336-9756.
I think that's probably the most telling sign of government misdirection. Whenever they say that this guy acted alone, or we have everybody who was involved, doubtless, and forget looking for anybody else who might be involved. Like with the shooter in Aurora, Colorado. You know, they're like, he acted alone. We know this for sure within an hour of the investigation. Or
even though all the witnesses say that there was another person
precisely
doing the shooting, and that, and the gas mask is actually 300 yards away at the other door on the other side where they said the gas canisters were coming from,
right,
which was completely farther away from where this guy was actually came out,
and he was sitting in his car already wearing a gas mask. So yeah, there's more than one. It just shows the government shuts down investigation. They say nothing to see here, we've got this figured out, everybody go back to sleep, just remember the terror that you feel.
That's right. And an important point is, in 1995, there was a terrorist legislation pending during the Clinton administration, right? And that was – and these weren't – didn't they bring people from survivors to Washington as witnesses to push it?
It was the omnibus anti-terrorism bill that was completely stalled out because, there was a large patriot movement in this country at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Oklahoma City bombing, it just fell through without any resistance. But before that, the American people wouldn't have tolerated it. Now, when you combine that to where we're at now, okay, I've got some associates, John Bush and Catherine Weiss, that go to the fusion centers and trying to raise awareness about fusion centers. They actually found a document there in the fusion center and supplied it to us, saying that State Representative Charles Keith, independent Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, is listed under domestic terrorists. Because they have the audacity to try to find out the truth. An elected official.
Now, James, could you explain to our listeners what a fusion center is?
A fusion center is it's for fusion of information. It's for multiple agencies within a state to interact with the federal agencies to fuse all the information together in one location. And this is where a lot of I think some of the violations of the Fourth Amendment, et cetera, are occurring.
It's particularly being used for political activities, right?
Yes.
These are the ones that correspond with the FEMA regions, right?
They're typically in major cities to pull the county, local, and federal agencies together to where they can.
Okay.
Share information. But, when we look at the information that comes out, I mean, obviously they're calling Charles Key a domestic terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
We look at that. You remember the MIAC report was the really big one that came out of that, where, they said if you've got a Ron Paul sticker on your car, or a Constitution sticker on your car, you're a terrorist,
Well, that's, you tie this in with the recent passage of the NDAA, where the president now has the authority to have the army arrest people who are associated in some way with groups that are associated with Al-Qaeda,
uh-huh,
right? And put them in a military prison. So we see how you can easily get into serious trouble with our government now if you're associated with some movement the government doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And this is
Al-Awlaki, he was having a breakfast at the Pentagon,
yep,
and then all of a sudden now he's a terrorist. Whenever American citizens, Obama authorized the drone attack that killed a 16-year-old American citizen without trial or jury or anything.
Yep.
He was judge, jury, and executioner. So it's already happening. This isn't something that's coming down the road, folks. We're here.
Mm-hmm.
What is a state crime against democracy? You talk about that?
Scads. Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. A Wendy Painting was one of the writers and researchers on the film, and she talks about state crimes against democracy. This is a growing movement within academia, taking a credible, approach to these types of events and investigating them, because most of the time the institutions that are put in charge of the investigation stand the most to lose.
And it's extraordinarily
frustrating.
Right. So it's extraordinarily frustrating to get at the truth. And we see that with 9/11,
mm-hmm,
where you can't, we had many of the victims' families were unsatisfied with the current investigation. So they got the 9/11 commission. And then what did the commission come up with? It didn't, they never talked to Stephen Jones, who is the physicist our listeners are familiar with, who's one of the lead scientists who's exposed the fact that the buildings were almost certainly demolished. They didn't come down the fire.
Which is why 3/4 of the commission said that they were set up to fail, that they were underfunded and they were denied access.
Some resigned, right?
And that was the most compelling bit of evidence in my mind's eye was, first of all, the first one was the report by the New York City fire marshals who said that, they discovered thermite in the basement still reacting days after the collapse of the towers. And then to hear them say that the towers couldn't have been brought down by the fuel burning, you know, because they had looked into the issue of insulating the beams and things like that. But they said, the fire marshal's office said the towers could not have been brought down by the fuel. And then you have Stephen Jones, who's a professor of physics, a professor of physics at Brigham Young University, who said there was no way on Earth that the towers could have been brought down by the burning
fuel. Well, even the NIST report said the collapse by fire had a low probability of occurrence. That's right. That's a direct quote.
1,700 licensed architects and engineers that are now signed the petition saying they need a real investigation of Building 7 mm-hmm. and how it collapsed. Mm-hmm.
This is Richard Gage and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean that now. I mean, I'm going to defer to the experts that have done the analysis, done the research, that have the education to understand this type of material. I think that when you've got 1,700 of them that are willing to put their reputations on the line like that, I think that in itself ought to be justification.
Is there any chance that we will ever get a really good investigation of 9/11 where people like Stephen Jones, a physicist, or Richard Gage, the architect, who pointed out these huge discrepancies between the science and what the government has put forth, any chance that there's going to be an opportunity for them to be heard? In a public
hearing? I think when you the only comparison I can do on that was again, the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee went to members of Congress, and those congressmen told them to go back and do a report. So they created what's called the final report. You can find that on Amazon.com, the final report. And this was the investigation the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee did, and they submitted it to Congress, and then 3 weeks later, 9/11 happened, and so it completely overshadowed it. But they were trying to get a congressional hearing and investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing, but after 9/11, there was no interest anymore.
Now, James, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I want to give you the opportunity to plug the website, the video, and any other materials.
And your new movie, which if you can mention that.
And if you're going to be appearing anywhere.
Yeah, that'd be great. Actually, we're going to be screening A Noble Lie tonight here in New York City at 56 Walker Street at INN Studios. It's part of the Off the Radar Film Festival.
Great.
People can go to anoblelie.com. They can purchase the movie there, or it's available on Amazon.com also. And we are pleased to announce that we are going to we're in full production. Well, actually, I'm sorry, we moved into post-production on our next film, State of Mind, The Psychology of Control. We're going to be covering compulsory schooling, indoctrination, propaganda, psychological warfare, and aspects of MKUltra.
Nice.
Very, very knowledgeable, credible people that we're bringing in on this. We're using the same methodology we used in The Noble Lie. We do not present conclusions. Mm-hmm. We present documented evidence and eyewitness testimony and leave it up to the intelligence of the audience to discern for themselves.
Great. See, you actually give respect to the audience to be able to make their own conclusion. You're just bringing the evidence and you say, make of this what you will, whereas most people just say, here's what you ought to believe. And so, Mr. Lane, we're going to have to leave it there. We thank you very much for joining us today, talking about this very important topic.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much,
James Lane, director of A Noble Lie. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, I had fun.
All right, great. Talk to you again.
And we will be here next week with the premise or the question, does capitalism work?
That's been or does capitalism exist in America?
Does capitalism work? And that's going to be our next show Monday, September 17th from noon to 1. We're on every Monday from noon to 1 in context, the WPKN's live public affairs call-in show.
Find us online at incontextreport.com. Find us on YouTube at youtube.com/incontextreport. And you can see a lot of our videos there, which have a firestorm of comments brewing.
Find us on Facebook at In Context.
Except on the first Monday. When Steve, our GM, will give us his report to the listeners.
So, see you again next time, guys.
See you next week. Thanks.
Going out with Won't Get Fooled Again. How does that sound?
Sounds good. Thank you, Marshawn.